This show is sponsored by BetterHelp. You know that feeling when you have something that's really been bothering you, or when you've been fixating on something in your life that's looming large in your mind? We all carry around different stressors in our lives, big and small, and I think we inherently know that when we keep them bottled up inside, it can start to affect us negatively. Therapy is a safe space to get things off your chest, and to figure out how to work through whatever it is that's weighing you down. Therapy isn't just for people who have experienced major trauma. There are plenty of benefits it can have for everyone. It's helpful for learning positive coping skills and how to set boundaries. And don't underestimate the power of boundaries either. Those are super important. If you've been wondering if you should give therapy a try, check out BetterHelp. It's a fully online experience and designed from the ground up to be convenient and customizable to your schedule. To get started, you just have to fill out a brief questionnaire that will match you up with a licensed therapist, and you can switch therapists at any time for no extra charge. Get it off your chest with BetterHelp. Visit betterhelp.com/filmdaily today to get 10% off your first month. That's BetterHelp, HELP.com/filmdaily.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
Hello everyone, and welcome to Slash Film Daily for Thursday, December 5th, 2019. On today's episode, we're going to gather around the virtual water cooler and talk about what we've been up to lately. My name is Ben Pearson, I'm the senior writer at SlashFilm.com, and I am joined on today's episode by Slash Film Managing Editor Jacob Hall.
Hello, hello.
Weekend Editor Brad Oman.
Hey, that's me.
And writers Y Tran Bui.
Hey, everyone.
And Chris Evangelista.
Hello, folks.
So Peter is still out at Disney World. I think he's traveling today, coming back, so he should be back tomorrow. But let's kick things off and talk about what we've been doing. HT, you're back from Vietnam. Welcome back.
I'm back.
So how was it? Baby.
It was great. I was gone for 2 weeks, and I went there with my grandmother, and I stayed at my aunt's place in Hanoi, and I mostly stayed around Hanoi because I was just kind of mostly there to chaperone my my grandmother. But I took a couple of day trips out of Hanoi for the 2 weeks I was there. I went to Dung Lam, which is an ancient village like a couple hours outside of Hanoi. And I went to Bat Giang as well, which is a ceramic village. Or rather, it's a village that specializes in ceramics, and you can do a pottery class and everything there. And I also went to Ha Long Bay, which I went to last time I was in Vietnam, and a mountain village called Sapa. And it was just great being back in Vietnam again after 15 years. 15 years ago was the first time I ever went, and I was a bit young back then. I was in middle school, and I didn't fully appreciate the traveling there the first time. I remember really being into this Lord of the Rings Game Boy game at the time, and basically spending a lot of time playing that instead of actually exploring the cities as I should have been. But I got to wander around and see Hanoi, and that was really great because it's changed a lot in the past 15 years. It's become a lot more metropolitan since I've been there. I know Vietnam has opened up its economy, so it's just very modern now. There are a lot more buildings, a lot higher, though it hasn't really much changed in the ways of its traffic. I remember when I was there last time, I was just so shocked because there aren't really any traffic laws. The majority of the vehicles there are motorbikes. They're not really like motorcycles. They're more along the lines of kind of a more high-powered scooter in a way, but they still go pretty fast. But most people ride around on these motorbikes versus cars. And I think now there's fewer motorbikes than before, but I think it's still like 80% motorbikes, 20% cars. And because these motorbikes are pretty fast and can weave in and out of traffic, they don't really pay attention to stop signs or traffic lights. There used to not be any traffic lights at all. Now there are, but they still don't pay attention to them. So when you're crossing the street, it's always kind of a gamble for your life. You just there aren't really a lot of crosswalks, and if there are, again, they don't pay attention to them, so you kind of just have to just start walking across, and the motorbikes will swerve around you. I was telling Ben earlier that I saw at one point a group of Australians who just were so nervous about crossing the street, they closed their eyes and just walked across, which is actually not a bad idea, because like you're not supposed to stop in the middle of the street, just kind of have to keep walking and just like, you know, keep going at it, because if you keep stopping and starting, then you will cause like traffic problems. But yeah, that's always interesting to do. But yeah, and it's such a chaotic city, and so there's just so much happening, but you get used to it after a while. And I got to ride a motorbike a couple times, because in Hanoi and in Southeast Asia in general, the common rideshare app there is something called Grab. They don't have Uber or Lyft. And Grab applies to both taxi cabs and regular cars and motorbikes. So, and the motorbike is like half the price of a car. So I would often just like, if I was going off the city by myself, I would just get a motorbike and sit in the back. And I took a few too many selfies that my drivers were just like, what are you doing? But yeah, that was fun. You might've seen on my Instagram, I cataloged or, you know, kept track of all my little adventures on my Instagram story, what was going on. I took a couple of videos from the motorbike, and I'm sure it looks a little scary. It's not terrible. You don't have anything to, you shouldn't, I kind of have to hang on a little bit to like the little handle in the back. But for the most part, people were just had their hands in their bags. They had like a bunch of boxes or something on their laps or something like that. Like people don't really have much, they kind of throw caution to the wind. And at one point I saw like just a dog chill in the back of a motorbike too. Like it's very normal. Means of transportation, and something that isn't quite as scary as for us people who aren't used to it.
Nice. HT, what the most important question, have you watched the most recent episode of Watchmen set almost entirely in Vietnam, and can you compare?
I haven't.
Okay.
Because it's really bad. Only Netflix really was available in Vietnam, because the VPN is different, and I mm-hmm. wasn't able to access any of my streaming platforms except for Netflix. So I was not caught up on Watchmen. But of course, as I was leaving Hanoi in the airport, they were playing the latest episode of Watchmen with no sound, but with Vietnamese subtitles, so I understood none of what was being spoiled for me.
Awesome. Well, yeah, I look forward to you catching up to that show so you can rejoin us on our Watchmen recap episodes. Real quick, before we move on from your Vietnam adventures, any highlights in terms of food? What was your favorite food there?
I mean, the pho there is incredible. And in Hanoi is like the northern part of Vietnam, so it generally gets a little bit colder than the rest of the country, so a pho is, you know, something that they take a real passion to. And so I had some really great pho thai, which is beef pho, at this place called Pho Ten Li Quoc Su. I'm very sorry for butchering the language which I grew up with. By the way, there was a unique shame I felt in this time around, especially since I had to communicate more on my own this time, in having a Vietnamese name and not knowing any Vietnamese. And I felt very bad every time I would call a Grab and they would see my name and start speaking to me in Vietnamese, and I'm like, I don't know what you're saying. And so that was really interesting. And it was even more so than when I was growing up in America and had to correct my substitute teachers every time when they mispronounced my name. This time around, I just felt like more shame about it than before. So I'm really sorry that I don't know more Vietnamese and that I could only communicate by saying hi and like food terms. But yeah, pho was great. And bún chả was delicious too. There was a great bún chả place near my aunt's house. Bún chả is a rice vermicelli noodle dish with pieces of like beef or like barbecued pork and barbecued beef. And I also had this great bún chả as well, which is the same thing, but it's a sweet and sour soup with rice vermicelli noodles and fried catfish, I think. which was really good. Another thing that was really funny that's all the rage now in Hanoi is egg coffee, which does sound strange, but it actually tasted very good. It's basically just like Vietnamese coffee with what is essentially a meringue on top. But it's made from egg yolks, not egg whites, which they made a lot of emphasis on because they basically like whip the egg yolks and add like a ton of sugar and like vanilla and all these things until it turns white. And they put it on top and it's super sweet, but it tasted delicious. So yeah, that's a new trend that's happening in Hanoi right now. There's a big coffee culture there as well. What else was really good that I ate? There's just like some... I also took a Vietnamese cooking class, so I got to cook a few dishes that I'll be adding into my regular rotation that were like staples of Hanoi as well, which include caramelized pork, which is delicious, and nam, which is basically like spring rolls fried.
Man, that sounds really good.
Mm-hmm. Awesome. I'm just like salivating now thinking about it. Before we move on to the next thing, and I'm sorry for talking about Vietnam for so long, but I had a lot of fun. I want to say that if you ever find yourself in Hanoi or like in the northern part of Vietnam, do check out Sapa. It was one of the most beautiful sort of areas that I visited. It's about 4 or 5 hour bus ride from Hanoi, and it's a sort of mountain town in the Hoang Lien Son Mountains where there's a large population of Hmong people. And this is, I did a 2-day, one night trek and homestay there. So the homestay is basically just like a nicer hostel. And it was such an incredible experience, even though the time I visited, it was really foggy, so I couldn't see a lot. But I did a trek about like 6 miles the first day, 3 miles the second day around these sort of mountainous areas in around Sapa. And I got to visit a lot of the villages around there and see the rice terrace paddies all around the mountains. And it's really gorgeous and just such a beautiful picture of Vietnamese like rural communities as well as the really rich ethnic communities around Vietnam. There are a lot of them, and it's so different just from like the south and the north as well as like the central mountainous areas.
Cool. Yeah, sounds like a lot of really good recommendations for anybody else who might be planning a trip out there. So just hearing you talk about it makes me want to go. So I think you're doing your job on behalf of the Vietnamese Board of Tourism, HD. So
go to Vietnam, try to learn some Vietnamese. How to say hello is xin chào, and then if you say that, they will start talking to you in Vietnamese, especially if you look more Asian. And I'm sorry.
For me, I recently celebrated the second annual Vince Garral Day, which is a made-up holiday that my wife and I created, which is something we celebrate the day after Thanksgiving. On our version of Black Friday is Vince Garral Day. It's basically where we just start listening to Christmas music, and that is the Vince Guaraldi Trio's soundtrack from A Charlie Brown Christmas. That's like, it marks the official beginning of the Christmas season for us. We go out and get our Christmas tree and all that stuff. So we did that day. That was really nice. I went to a special fan event in Hollywood for The Witcher, the new Netflix series starring Henry Cavill. And they had like a whole thing set up where you could like walk into the world of The Witcher. And it was kind of strange because we got to, like, my wife and I went and we got to go through this experience where it was like they had performers and people dressed up in period appropriate or setting appropriate attire for whatever fantasy world The Witcher takes place in. And it was strange because we don't know anything about The Witcher. I've not read any of the books on which the series is based. I've never played any of the popular Witcher video games. So I was walking into this thing completely, I didn't know anything at all about this entire franchise. So They had like a live horse there, and they said that the horse's name was Roach, which they had the sign set up where it was basically like you're supposed to like unburden yourself on this horse, like tell it all of your deepest, darkest secrets, or like complain to it about people that are bothering you or something. And I felt so bad for this horse, like having to sit here and just listen to all these people complain to it all day. But it was like a huge fan event, and there was massive lines down the block in Hollywood, and all these people came into this thing. So, you know, some of the finer nuance and the points of Witcher lore were definitely lost on me, because I, you know, walked through this thing before I saw the screening of the first episode. So, yeah, I'm sure the fans actually, you know, people who have been obsessed with this property for a long time got a lot more of that out of that than I did. In terms of the first episode, I'll just talk about that really quickly here. There's a lot of Game of Thrones in this, in terms of like both the, you know, the fantasy aspect, but also like some plot stuff, and which I won't get into, but also a couple shots in particular. There's one shot where and longtime Game of Thrones fans will know it the second you see it. It happens like, you know, late in this episode, where the same thing happens, and it's framed in a very similar way to one of the most memorable shots in Game of Thrones. And I'm just sort of like, why are you trying to invite these comparisons, Witcher? What are you doing here? But Henry Cavill is pretty decent in the show. It's got some good sword play. I'm not fully on board, but I am intrigued. So I think that says a lot for me, somebody who like generally pulls the ripcord and bails out away from TV shows that don't immediately hook me. This one, I'm not ready to pull the ripcord quite yet. So I think that's as rousing a recommendation as I can give for The Witcher after seeing only one episode. But I know the whole season drops on Netflix on December 20th. So look forward to that if you're into that whole thing. And then finally, I visited Studio Movie Grill, which is a theater in Glendale, for the first time. They asked me if I wanted to come out there and see a movie, and they were going to give me some food and stuff. I suspect it's because I looked up their I looked them up on Yelp, and they didn't really have great reviews on Yelp, and I suspect this is sort of like an attempt to sort of counteract that a little bit, maybe like some image rebranding, reputation sort of building exercise on their part. But yeah, this is a really nice theater. It was super clean, and the seats are like huge, and you know, they've got like the mechanical buttons where you can kick your feet out and all that stuff. The seats are really big. They have heated seats, like butt warmers, and then they also have cup holders that have like refrigeration on them, which I'd never seen before, so I thought that was cool. But yeah, it's a really nice theater in Glendale. If you are in that area and looking for a quiet, there weren't really too many people there on a Wednesday night, so if you're looking for like a quiet movie going place that has like, you know, decent enough food for movie theaters, then that's the place to go. I would say the only, like, the biggest downside is that there's not enough room between the rows for the people bringing you the food to be able to do so without really blocking the screen very much, or to be able to do so in the way that they do at Alamo Drafthouse, where it's like you barely notice that the people were there bringing you stuff. So that would be the one downside. But anyway, that's Studio Movie Grill in Glendale. Jacob, what have you been doing?
I've had my nose buried in work, Ben. We're planning Slash Film's big end of the decade blowout, and we have literally dozens of things planned, just from freelancers and from this core staff, just attacking the past 10 years from every angle possible. So that's been pretty much, if I'm not doing something directly related to like today's work, I've been buried in that in some capacity, and I'm feeling pretty excited. And what we'll be doing is deciding the top 100 films of the decade on a podcast. You'll get to hear the entire discussion play out and hear us hopefully argue and agree and argue and agree. And I'm really, really excited about that. We actually just finished the nominating process. Everybody nominated their picks. And let's put it this way. There are 163 films vying for the top 100 slots. So 63 films got to go. And then we'll figure out the ranking beyond that. But I already told everybody this, so I want to share it with the listeners as a tease. Only four films received the nominations from all six members of the Slash Film staff. So that pretty much means that only four films were agreed upon by everybody that they deserve to be in the top of the list. And those four films are Arrival, The Social Network, Inception, and Star Wars The Last Jedi. Doesn't mean they're going to be in the top 10 or top 5 even. But those are the four films that were on everybody's nominations list. So I think it's a pretty good indication that we have a pretty fun, varied list, guys, right?
I think so, certainly. Do you want to tease a couple of the individual Best of the Decade features that are coming, too? I mean, you don't have to go through the whole list because there's a whole lot of coverage coming, but any that you are particularly excited about?
How about each of you go around the circle? Tell listeners one thing you're writing. We'll do that.
Oh, Ben, what are you working on? I'm going to work on the best domestically released, like American action movies of the decade.
Rob Hunter, a friend of the site and writer for us, is doing best non-American action films. So,
Chris, what are you working on?
I'm doing most underrated films of the decade. Thank you.
All right. HT, what are you working on?
Oh, no surprise here, but I'm working on a best animated movie of the decade list, and there are a few animes in there.
I will say we also have a top 10 anime of the decade coming, in addition to that. And we also have a top 10 animated television shows of the decade, like American television shows. So we're getting animation from several angles here.
Wow. All right.
Yeah.
Brad, what are you working on?
I have been taking on the responsibility of figuring out what the best comedies were of the decade, and I've got a list of 20, and they are funny movies because I love to laugh.
As a tease, we have someone else doing the top 10 breakout comedic performers. So in addition to the funniest movies, we'll have one focus on people. And we also have, you know, things like the biggest comebacks, the biggest, most important reinventions, the filmmakers who defined the decade. We have some very specific ones, and we have some very, very broad ones. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Awesome. Lists I'm looking forward to that.
Lists we won't be doing. Best salads of the decade. favorite animal fights.
I mean, now that you mention it, Brad, favorite animal fights on film? That sounds like an awesome list.
That's a good point. What were we thinking?
Well, Brad, let's go to you. What have you been up to recently?
Watching animal fights. So my girlfriend's birthday was earlier this week, and so I took a day off, and we went to Chicago to spend the day out there doing some stuff. We went to this small market called the Christkindl Market, which is a German Christmas market that's set up in Daly Plaza in Chicago, where they have it almost looks like a little village market. And they have like handmade ornaments and Christmas decorations and other various holiday items. They have different foods you can try, like roasted nuts and like international candies and hot chocolate and pastry and just all this cool stuff that's there. And so I had driven by it a few times just being in Chicago during the holidays, but never checked it out until this time. And it's a cool, adorable little thing. It's a little pricey, kind of like going to, you know, a carnival or something like that. It's almost has prices that are close to, like, you know, movie theater concessions prices or even like ballpark prices. You know, definitely paying more for things than you otherwise would anywhere else. But, you know, the experience is fun. It kind of gives you just a nice holiday feeling. Mm-hmm. You know, it's enjoyable.
You had some coffee when you were in Chicago?
We didn't actually have coffee. We kind of just did this just by happenstance because I forgot this was even a thing. But Starbucks just recently opened the world's largest Starbucks that is actually one of their roasteries in Chicago. And we were on the Magnificent Mile just walking around to some various shops. And we happened to stumble upon it because it's on Michigan Avenue. And so we're like, oh, yeah, let's go ahead and check this out. Honestly, it's fine for what it is. It really is just a big Starbucks. It's cool because it has different levels with different things you can do. It's not just one big regular Starbucks. There's like a level where they have dedicated to experiential coffee, and there's a level where they have a bar where you can get a lot of different coffee flavored alcoholic drinks. And of course, you can, you know, they have a lot of the actual roastery, you know, equipment and industrial stuff on display there. A weird aside, the first time I've ever experienced this, there was a spiral escalator, which kind of weirded me out because I had never seen one of those before. Have you guys ever seen a spiral escalator?
No.
Yeah. So it was an escalator that just goes around in like a half circle up instead of just the straight up and down stairs. It was very weird. But it was, you know, it is what it is. There's a lot of people there checking it out. I would be interested to go back when I have time to actually try some of the more unique things it offers as opposed to just the regular Starbucks offerings, but it's definitely a big Starbucks. And then another random thing that we happen to walk by is there's a big flagship AT&T store that is on Michigan Ave in Chicago, and they had this Friends pop-up quote-unquote experience where they basically set up like a makeshift Central Perk. It wasn't a working Central Perk. They weren't like serving coffee and snacks, but they had like a photo op to sit on like the Friends couch that they have set up there with the display set behind it. They had some props from the show on display. And then they had this interactive thing screen in the store where it went through Friends each year, focusing on like the different technology, like the old school big laptops and flip phones and all this stuff, tying it into AT&T. And like, it was funny because it got towards the end, once it got past the time that Friends was on the air, it was just generically talking about like phones and technology and trying to tie it into Friends. But they did have like Chandler's laptop on display there and his beeper. And it's kind of funny the way that the big screen thing was talking about all this stuff is like how it's so ancient and, oh, look at these novelty items. And it's like, man, I was around when this stuff was like a cool thing. And it just made me feel old.
Yep. I feel you. Okay, so let's go into what we've been reading. The only thing that I've been reading recently is I finally finished reading Dune, the Frank Herbert novel from 1965. It took me a long time to read this book. I mean, it's a pretty big book. It's pretty dense, but I wanted to read it because I know Jacob is a big fan of it. I think HC, you read it recently too, and there's a movie coming out. I remember HC, you saying that you liked the book a lot. I kind of hated the experience of reading it. I think it took me a long time to read because I wasn't super into it, and I would just sort of dread picking it back up again and diving in because I felt like I was really into the beginning of the book where there's a lot of like political intrigue and, you know, like setting up who these families are in this, you know, space world. And, you know, it's like a lot of like Game of Thrones style sort of royal scheming and politicking and all of that kind of stuff. And I was into that stuff. And then basically for like, I don't know, I would say the back two thirds of the book is all sort of in this this sand world, the Dune planet, and it's all like I don't know, without really getting into spoilers about the plot or anything, because I know the movie's coming up, and if people want to go into that fresh, I want to sort of honor that notion for people. But I don't know, I just found it very like repetitive, and like there's a whole white savior narrative that I wasn't really thrilled about. And the main character, Paul Atreides, is like this, you know, almost like superhuman smart, and like he has like this mega intelligence, the likes of which the universe has never seen. And I just sort of like rolled my eyes every time they would talk about like how incredible he was at like pinpointing exactly what somebody would do at the exact time. And I don't know, am I the only person here who didn't enjoy reading this book? Jacob, why do you love Dune so much?
First of all, I want to say every single thing you just said, every single criticism is not inaccurate, and it's been part of the conversation of this book for decades. So you are not the only one to feel that way. And Dune being this tedious, boring white savior story has been the biggest criticism against it for as long as I've been alive, and perhaps longer. So this is not something I anyone would be mad at you for saying. I like Dune in spite of everything you just said. I think Dune's world building is incredible. I think that the fictional cultures it examines are rich with detail, and it is unfortunately written by a white guy in the 60s. And that's why I'm thrilled that this world be brought to life by, you know, a filmmaker with modern sensibilities with Denis Villeneuve's new film. I love Dune for so many reasons, but nothing you said is inaccurate or incorrect.
Aishi, do you have any follow-up thoughts on Dune now that you've sort of had a chance to sit with it for a little bit longer?
No, yeah, I still really liked it. It took me a little bit to get into it as well, but I was also similarly hooked by the political intrigue and the scheming, as you were. And then when the book did this big 180 and turned into this mystical sort of epic, that I was a little bit thrown for a loop, but I still really enjoyed that because I love mystical shit. I'm a huge fan of that kind of stuff. So I was also all down for it, even though I was really wary of the problematic, to say the least, sort of you know, racially coded characters. Mm-hmm. But I just really enjoyed how wacky and weird, and again, like, the world building, the detail was just so big and immersive that I just ended up really enjoying it. And I also saw, like, the criticism you have, Ben, but I just really like that kind of big sort of fable-like story. So mm-hmm. I was really in on the second half of Dune.
Yeah, I'm very intrigued about the movie because I think they're supposed to be splitting this book into two films, and I think I'm really going to like the first movie, and I'm really not going to like the second movie if it's anything like the book. But I trust in Denis Villeneuve. He's made incredible movies. You know, he's the guy behind Blade Runner 2049 and Sicario and Prisoners and Enemy and a bunch of great stuff. So
Arrival, soon Arrival. To be in slash film's best of decades list.
Yes, of course. all right, so let's jump into what we've been watching. Chris, you and I saw 1917. You reviewed this movie for the site. I have to admit to you, I have it bookmarked, but I've not had a chance to read your review yet. What did you think about 1917?
I really liked it. I thought it was going to be gimmicky because, you know, the whole thing is it's being sold as it's set up to look like it's a one-take movie where it follows these characters, you know, across World War One in one unbroken shot. And I was worried. I was like, oh, that's going to be, you know, there's not going to be much more to it than that. But, you know, it is a technical achievement. It looks amazing. I mean, Roger Deakins does the cinematography and he does an amazing job of making it look like it's one shot, even though it obviously isn't. But I was actually really impressed with the emotional stuff in it. There are some really big emotional beats in the film that really resonated with me. It takes time to, you know, get into these characters' heads and you know, explore the horrors of war. And, you know, it's a really, like, nasty movie. There's a lot of, like, horrific stuff in there, but there's these, like, moments where elements of beauty come shooting through all the mud and blood, and I was really impressed with that. So I liked it more than I thought I was going to.
Yeah, I did too. I also thought that the one take thing would kind of take me out of it. I thought I would kind of, like, be constantly looking for where they make the hidden cuts, you know, because there's no way they actually did it in one real full shot like they did for, like, that movie Victoria, for example, recently. So I was like, okay, what do you got? You know, like, show me what you got, movie. And it actually, like, far surpassed my expectations. I'm right there with you where I found it to be a very emotional experience, like, more so than I anticipated by a long shot. And I think the one shot aspect of it kind of fades away at a certain point. Like, the blocking in this movie is so good that even though it's one shot and typically editing is used to you know, force the audience to look at certain things, I think this, or at least pay attention to certain things, I think the blocking in this movie, like, there are shots where the camera, you know, is right up next to the characters, and then it backs away a little bit and, like, lets something else pass in the foreground, and you're paying attention to all of these different aspects. It's like a different visual language than what we normally see. So I was very impressed with it on a technical level, but yeah, also the emotions really worked on me too. So I thought it was just going to be like a sort of a heartless exercise, and I came away like being like, I think this is one of my favorite movies this year. So that was a big surprise for me, but I'm excited for the rest of you guys to see it. And I feel like, Chris, maybe you and I might be arguing for, like, a couple moments from this movie to be in our you know, like, favorite moments of the year, if we do that as a big podcast or something too. So, all right. So that's 1917. I think it comes out in theaters. Do you have the release date in front of you?
Christmas Day, actually. Okay. I think it comes out Christmas Day.
Okay. Yeah. So definitely add that to your watch list, 'cause I think it's 100% worth seeing. All right. So The Irishman finally hit Netflix. Chris, you and HT had seen this at the New York Film Festival premiere. It seems like you've been watching this one a lot, right?
Yeah, I watched it twice since it's dropped onto Netflix. I'm actually, like, in the middle of watching it a third time in chunks, because I like this movie, in case you can't tell. I don't know. I know people have problems with the length. I know people have problems with the pacing, but none of that bothers me. I mean, whenever a long movie is great, I want to spend as much time with that movie as possible. The other example I can think of is like Zodiac, which is a long movie that I never get tired of rewatching. And I really love this movie. I love this world, and I don't think I'll ever really get sick of this movie. So that's me.
Well, Chris, I'm not going to tell you that this movie's bad, because it's definitely not. And
Ben, don't make me come through this microphone and strangle you.
No, I'm just going to say, I want to be the voice for any listeners out there who have seen the effusive praise for this movie and kind of felt a little bit on the outside looking in, because I liked this movie and was certainly not in love with it. I feel like the final, I don't know, 30 minutes, an hour, whatever it is, where Robert De Niro's character essentially like grapples with his aging and his life in a serious way, is what I wished a lot more of the movie was. And it's, I find myself in this weird place of like loving that part of the film, but not really connecting with a lot of what came before, but also at the same time recognizing that you need all of the stuff that came before for that last part to actually be effective. So I don't know, I find myself sort of on the fence with The Irishman in terms of like, I love the messages that it departs at the end, but I guess speaking of the word departed, I would much rather watch like The Departed like, you know, two or three times in a row than I would rewatch The Irishman. So I think that's the biggest difference between us there, Chris. But I suspect everybody else on this podcast has seen this movie. I know, Brad, you talked about it recently too. Jacob, have you seen it yet? Did you talk about it recently? Am I just forgetting that?
Yeah, I saw it in theaters when it was in that limited release, and I'm very much on Team Chris here. I'm not going to say you're wrong, Ben, but goodness, this movie really worked for me.
Okay, good, good, good. All right, I just wanted to, make sure that everybody has had their chance to sort of weigh in on this film. And I think Peter saw it as well, so maybe he'll be able to talk about that on the next Water Cooler.
Peter tweeted that he liked it but didn't love it, so you have an ally here, Ben.
Okay, all right. It's always interesting to be allied with Peter on film thoughts and takes sometimes, because he has some weird ones, but I look forward to hearing him talk about this movie too.
We love you, Peter.
All right, so Chris, Brad, and HT watched Knives Out, the new Rian Johnson movie. Chris, what did you think about it?
I loved it. I saw this at TIFF, but my wife wanted to see it, so over the Thanksgiving weekend, we went and saw it, and I still love it. I think I liked it even more the second time. It's just so much fun.
Brad, what did you think?
Yeah, I also loved it. It's just, it's so sharp and just well-written, and you can tell Rian Johnson really has a love for the classic murder mystery, and he takes that formula and makes it contemporary without losing any of like what makes a classic murder mystery work so well. I think if it has one shortcoming, it's that some of the social and political commentary that comes through at times feels a little forced and clunky. There is an overall thematic element of it that works very well by the time you get to the end. I'm not going to spoil anything, obviously, but there's some of it that is injected throughout that didn't quite land as well for me, even though I appreciated it. But everyone in this movie is so great. I didn't realize, based simply on the marketing or anything, that Ana de Armas was the lead, essentially, and Daniel Craig is just outstanding. I want to see him solve more mysteries until the end of time. Jamie Lee Curtis, Chris Evans, Don Johnson, everybody is just so good in this movie. There's amazing performances, both big and small, and it's just, yeah, so much fun.
HT, what'd you think about Knives Out?
Everything that everyone has been saying is true. It's such a great, satisfying whodunit in the vein of all the great Agatha Christie murder mysteries. I really love Daniel Craig's Benoit Blanc and how much of a satire of Hercule Poirot he is, but still is a competent detective. And I think that every movie from now on, Daniel Craig should just be doing the crispiest, deep fried of Southern accents, because he was just having a blast in this movie, as was everyone. I just really enjoy to see this entire cast riffing and having the greatest time. And I do agree too with some of Brad's criticism. I do think some of the social messaging was a little on the nose. I think it worked for the most part, but it was kind of a little just they hammered it in a little too much at times. But I just really enjoyed it and how like visually just fun it was. So yeah, Knives Out, good movie.
I want to respond real quickly to the social stuff, because I think it works really well in the movie. But I also want to point out that in an interview with Rian Johnson that ran on this podcast, he talks about how he wanted to create a film that felt like essentially a period piece before it could be a period piece. So if people watch this in 20 years, they can meet and say, oh, that film's set in 2019. Same way you can watch a movie and say, oh, it's set in 1936. So I think the social stuff works if you look at it like that. But maybe I'm being weird.
No, I think you're right. There's a long lens to it. Yeah.
Yeah, no, I can appreciate that. I think it's just the way that it comes up in a couple scenes just feels shoehorned in there. But at the same time, I do forgive it to a certain extent, simply because those conversations do arise in family conversation. And so it's not as if it's not natural as far as the characters are concerned, but the way it comes about in the movie just feels like, whoa, that came out of nowhere.
Yeah. All right, so let's see. What else do we have? Me and Brad and Chris all watched A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. Why don't you guys talk about this one first? Chris, what did you think about this?
This is, again, another thing I saw at TIFF and my wife wanted to see, so we saw that over the Thanksgiving weekend, too. And it's very good. I actually liked this more this time than I did when I saw that TIFF. I didn't hate it at TIFF. I just thought it was kind of average, but I kind of liked it a lot more this time. I do think the script is really like on the nose at times, and I'm not really as wrapped up in the story of the cranky journalist as I think the movie wants you to be, but Tom Hanks is so good at playing Mr. Rogers, and he really nails like the way Mr. Rogers talked, that really like soft spoken way. He really gets that down really well, and he makes the movie really worth seeing.
Brad, what'd you think?
I liked it a lot too. It's it was a little more odd than I was anticipating, almost quirky in a way, because it's not your traditional biopic, and the way it's framed is done so as if it were like an episode of Mr. Rogers, but where they're telling the story of this journalist and how he met Mr. Rogers. And I wasn't expecting that, and it was a little bit I don't know, disorienting at first, but I appreciated the craft that it went into, especially the way they utilize the diorama set from Mr. Rogers' original show and added certain elements to it. That it was a nice touch, and it was refreshing in a way that it wasn't just your typical biopic. I think Tom Hanks is outstanding in this movie. It's interesting though, because I don't think he necessarily does this perfect impersonation of Fred Rogers. Like Chris talked about, like the way he talks, and he does speak very well as Mr. Rogers, but it's not this impersonation. He more so just captures the spirit and has a little bit of the way that Fred Rogers used to talk as far as his like dialect is concerned. But I was really impressed just by how smitten I was with that performance despite that. There's almost something about Tom Hanks's extremely kind eyes that really reels you in, and like it makes what he says as Mr. Rogers hit that much harder in your heart. And like he just has the most calming, like beautiful expression on his face, just the way he looks into the other character's eyes, and that's what made it so touching to me. And there are so many scenes that I was surprised that kind of got me emotional about it, but it's a great movie. I think I liked it more than I thought that I would, but for reasons that I wasn't expecting.
Interesting. Yeah, I found it to be kind of a middling movie with a great Tom Hanks performance. I thought he is absolutely the reason to see this thing, and like Chris, I wasn't nearly as wrapped up in the journalist story, and frankly, any time Tom Hanks was not on the screen, I kind of, like, almost lost interest in the movie and was just sort of like looking at my watch and waiting for Tom Hanks to come back, because he is so compelling in that role, and the rest of the movie around it just feels very run-of-the-mill and sort of like you've kind of seen the story before, and it's not a very visually dynamic movie, and even the drama that plays out is not like particularly new, or it didn't strike me as super interesting. So it was more just like a showcase for, I thought the movie was more of a showcase for Tom Hanks as Mr. Rogers. And I think you guys are really like nailing the fact that he's captured the spirit of Mr. Rogers without doing an impression, and like the voice work and all of that stuff. I thought it was more about the speed of Mr. Rogers than anything. Like that's the fact that Tom Hanks speaks so slowly and deliberately in, you know, this fast-paced world that we live in right now, like, just the fact that he seems to really take his time and, you know, to speak and think about what he's saying, it forces you as an audience member to slow yourself down a little bit too. And the, I don't know, it's tough talking about this movie in the wake of the Mr. Rogers documentary that came out. What was that, last year or the year before? Because it's really, it's not the same story, but the Mr. Rogers of it all is kind of, it kind of gives you the same feeling. And to me, the documentary is so much more powerful in that way, because it's actually him and the emotions that he's able to elicit from people, especially at the end of that documentary. There's this moment where basically you just see like a bunch of talking heads like break down and cry because of this big moment of silence that that happens at the end of this movie. And A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood tries to have its own version of that, and it's just not nearly as affecting. I don't want to get into spoilers, but people who have seen both projects probably know what I'm talking about. So I just thought that was kind of an odd choice, but yeah, Tom Hanks is great in it. And, I think overall I like enjoyed the movie because he was in it, and I absolutely would not recommend it if he wasn't in it. So, it's sort of a weird one for me, but that is A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood. It's in theaters right now. Brad, you and I watched Klaus on Netflix. Is that how you say it? Is that, or is it Claus or Klaus? I think the character refers to him as Klaus at one point.
Yeah, it's Klaus.
Okay. So what did you think about this film? It's an animated movie. Chris talked about it, I think, on the last water cooler that we did. Brad, what did you think?
I was very surprised by how great this movie was. I think that great Christmas movies are few and far between. And animated Christmas movies, maybe even more so, because they often lean into silly slapstick stuff just for the kids, don't really have much of an original story. And this movie, first of all, it has absolutely gorgeous animation. And while it does have some comedy in it and some stuff that kids will enjoy, I love its approach to the mythos surrounding Santa Claus, and how it creates sort of an origin story for him without being blatant about it. Not like guys, this is where Santa Claus came from. It comes about naturally, and it does it in a really clever way. And this, it kind of felt like an old school animated movie for me, in the vein of like an American Tale or something like that. It had a little bit of an edge to it, and felt like it definitely kept grown-ups in mind. It wasn't made strictly to cash in on kids who just want to go to the movies and eat popcorn and have a good laugh. Mm-hmm. I really enjoyed this a lot. The voice cast is outstanding. It's a very touching, heartfelt story. I would go so far as to say it's probably a new holiday favorite for me, and easily my favorite Christmas movie since probably Elf.
Yeah, yeah. I agree. I saw the trailer for this movie and sort of rolled my eyes at it and was planning on skipping it entirely because of all of the reasons that you said about like typical Christmas movie stuff. Like modern day Christmas movies are, good ones are really, really tough to find. But then Chris talked about it last week and said it was surprisingly good. And I was like, if Chris was won over by an animated Christmas movie on Netflix, I think this thing is going to be pretty good. And I was surprised, or not really surprised, to find that that actually was the case. So thank you, Chris, for that recommendation. I really, really enjoyed this movie. I think the first 5 minutes or so, my wife and I looked at each other and we kind of rolling our eyes a little bit because some of the comedy was like a little rough, and the setup, like getting that main character off on his to start his journey, was a little rough. But within 5 or 10 minutes, it sort of quickly leaves that stuff behind and becomes this really, really gorgeously animated and surprisingly organic retelling of the Santa Claus origin story. So highly, highly recommend Klaus on Netflix right now. I watched Unbelievable, the limited series, also on Netflix. Has anybody else here seen this? I feel like Peter talked about it at one point, but I need to go back and listen to his water cooler entry on that. I don't remember if he actually finished the series, but this is a mini series about a series of rapes in Washington and Colorado. It's based on a true story, and it's all about these police detectives who realize that these seemingly separate cases are all connected. Has anybody else seen this? No, nobody's. Oh man. All right. Well, As you can tell from the subject matter, it's a little bit of a tough watch at times. There's some pretty rough imagery in there, but I think this is it's one of my favorite shows on TV of 2019. I think it's a tremendously organized and acted and directed series. Lisa Cholodenko directed several of the episodes. It stars Toni Collette and Merritt Weaver and Caitlin Dever, and all three of them are really, really great in it. Yeah, like I said, it's kind of a hard watch. I don't necessarily know if I'd recommend like throwing this on with the family while you're, you know, hanging out post Christmas or something. But I think it's like Ava DuVernay's When They See Us. It's sort of tough subject matter, but I think like essential TV. So definitely check that out if you have the stomach for it. Watch Unbelievable. It's very, very good. Has anybody else here seen Queen and Slim? I had a chance to see this one recently. Anybody?
No, I want to. Yeah, I want to try to see it, but I haven't had the time yet.
Yeah, so I found a lot to like in this movie. I think it is. It's the directorial debut of Melina Mansoukas, who's directed a lot of Beyonce videos, and she directed the episode of Master of None, the Thanksgiving episode of the, I think it was the first season of that series, where Lena Waithe comes out to her family, and Lena Waithe she wrote Queen and Slim. And Mansoukas comes in, and she's making her feature directorial debut with this movie, and it's a very powerful story, and it has some like incredible imagery in it. There's scenes where these two characters who are on the run because of a police shooting gone wrong situation. Man, it's so powerful in certain moments, and the ending has such like an emotional wallop to it. It's tough to talk about without spoiling, so I'll just say that I recommend watching it, and I also recommend trying to read as much criticism of it as you can by a lot of the critics of color that are out there. Don't just take my word for it, because I know there are a lot of diverging opinions about this movie and its effectiveness and you know, how it stands in the culture right now. So maybe I'll try to link to some of those in the show notes just to give people a jumping off point. But Queen and Slim is in theaters right now, and yeah, I would recommend watching it. It's a very powerful movie. I also had a chance to see Clute for the first time. This is the, what year did this come out? 1971 movie by Alan J. Bakula. It stars Jane Fonda and Donald Sutherland. Jacob, this seems like it would be something that you would like. Have you seen Clute?
Clute is one of those movies I have not seen, Ben, but like you, it's probably been sitting on the back of my radar for years.
It has, yes.
I've seen Clute.
I was going to go to you next, Chris. I suspected you might have. So, okay, well, yeah, what did you think about it before I give my two cents?
Clute rules, and Jane Fonda is insanely attractive in the movie Clute, so everyone should watch Clute.
I agree about Jane Fonda. I think she is, like, this is one of the best Jane Fonda performances I've ever seen. I thought she was tremendous in this movie. She was doing so much. It's one of these, like, paranoid 1970s movies. Wikipedia says that it's sort of, like, in this this trilogy, of this, like, loose trilogy of The Parallax View and All the President's Men, sort of, like, the same kind of vibe going through, you know, from the same director. Man, I liked this movie a lot. I think Donald Sutherland in it is sort of like a wet paper bag. Like it's really strange seeing young Donald Sutherland as somebody who only like primarily knows him from his old works. This is the youngest I've ever seen him, but I just didn't really think he brought much to this movie. But Jane Fonda does enough heavy lifting in it as this sort of sex worker who. I mean, the story gets a little bogged down at times, but I think it's absolutely worth seeking out for this tremendous Jane Fonda performance. So that's Clute. It was on Turner Classic Movies was where I saw it. I think I saw that it might be coming to the Criterion Channel sometime soon, so maybe keep an eye out.
It's on there now, actually.
Okay, cool. So yeah, that might be where you can track that down. And then my wife and I also just sort of like burned through several of our our favorite annual Christmas movies that we watch every year. So we watched Muppet Family Christmas, Frosty the Snowman, and Mickey's Christmas Carol, none of which I'm really going to offer anything new about, but you know, it's Christmas movie season. So I just wanted to throw it out to you guys really quickly. Do you have any other, Chris, I know you're about to talk about one, actually, a movie that you watch every Christmas, but do you guys have like a particular time of year where you watch your favorite Christmas movies? Is it like right after Thanksgiving, or do you wait until a little closer to Christmas itself? Let's just go around the circle. I want to know how you guys do this. HT, how do you do it?
You're going to hate me, but I love watching Love Actually. And my friends and I have actually planned a sort of tradition of watching Love Actually together. And we've added Die Hard to that. Party to make you feel better. But yeah, we
talk about whiplash.
I know. But yeah, I like to watch that, and Elf is another go-to that I like to see around Christmas time. I'm just a fan of the season, and we'll watch most any Christmas movie except for Polar Express because it is terrible.
Brad, what about you? When's your time frame for Christmas movies?
Yeah, pretty much right after Thanksgiving as well. And I will also admit, just like HT, I actually love Actually.
Yes, I know you do.
In spite of its problems, obviously it has problems now, but yeah, it's a very enjoyable, funny movie, and the cast is great. But we, my family and I just recently watched Planes, Trains, and Automobiles, which is more of a Thanksgiving movie, but it still works for Christmas because it's still holiday themed, and that movie is so great. We threw on Muppet Christmas Carol recently, and my girlfriend, because she grew up in Zimbabwe, didn't grow up watching the stop-motion animated Bass and Rankin Christmas specials, so I showed her Santa Claus Is Coming to Town and Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer for the first time, and she had a good laugh while watching those.
What a surreal experience watching those, like, as an adult for the first time.
Yeah, because they're classics, but man, they're so weird.
Jacob, what about you? Do you have like a specific week or something where you try to knock out all your favorite Christmas movies?
No specific week. Muppet Christmas Carol is the only one that happens every year. But other than that, it's kind of rotation on what we're looking for. And Ben, Love Actually is mostly good, except for Andrew Lincoln's character, who is a creep and a scumbag. And the fact that the movie thinks his character is a romantic is a blight on a movie I otherwise like. So I'll agree with you that Andrew Lincoln's character in Love Actually is as bad as everything else you say it is.
Actually, I will add to that the story with Colin, I think, in America is probably the worst storyline in Love Actually.
That's the second worst. It is a bad, bad storyline, but that character is just a big old goof as opposed to a creep stalker.
So you've heard it here first. A couple of Love Actually fans are talking about bad stuff in Love Actually.
I feel criticize things we love.
It has 1800
that's the whole thing about loving movies. You can like dislike things about things you love.
Yeah. All right, Chris. So let's go to you, and then we can lead into stuff that you've been watching lately. So how do you handle Christmas movies in the Evangelista household?
We don't really have like a sort of like set time. It's basically any time this month, and we have like a handful of movies we watch. Like Home Alone is one. I'm not like the biggest Home Alone fan, but my wife really likes it, so we watch that. What else? The Muppet Christmas Carol is the big one. I try to watch It's a Wonderful Life every year. I also try to make my wife watch it, but she literally falls asleep every time we try to watch it. So that's really
has
just
she ever
me.
Finished it?
No, we have never been able to. Every time I put it on every Christmas season, she makes it like not even like a full hour in before she just zonks out. So
she sees all the suicide and death, not the redemption.
Right.
No wonder she doesn't want to finish it.
Right.
All right. Well, what have you been watching recently, Chris?
So I guess I'll lead with my one Christmas movie I watch every year, and that's Eyes Wide Shut, which is my favorite Christmas movie. And I know people will not consider that a Christmas movie, but I do because it's very Christmassy. There's like a Christmas tree in almost every scene. There's Christmas decorations everywhere. And it's just about, you know, paranoia and frustration and all this other stuff I really love. Honestly, it's probably like my second favorite Kubrick movie. My first is probably Barry Lyndon. And I just love Eyes Wide Shut. And I know some people don't like Eyes Wide Shut, and those people are wrong.
I still have never seen that movie. I need to correct that this year.
Oh, my God, Ben, watch it. Watch it on Christmas Eve. Gather the family around.
Ben, I've worked with you long enough to know your tastes. Ben, HT, both of you, I know you well enough and know your tastes well enough. I think you would both get a lot out of it. So I'm going to second Chris's recommendation. This Christmas, as your editor, I am ordering both of you to watch Eyes Wide Shut.
All right.
You should.
Okay.
The other thing I watched is Hustlers, which is the J-Lo stripper movie. And I'd been like avoiding this just because I was, the trailers didn't look that great to me. But people kept saying like, oh, it's really good. And I got sent a copy on Blu-ray to review and I was like, fine, I will watch it. And I really loved it. Oh man, Hustlers is great. It's so good actually that it's in my top 10 of the year. I'm not even kidding. It's so entertaining. And it's so well made, and Jennifer Lopez is phenomenal, and like this is without a doubt like the best performance she's ever given, like in her entire career. And if you out there have avoided watching Hustlers, check it out because it's great.
I'm surprised to hear that it's in your top 10. That makes me want to go out of my way to see it now because I was not expecting that high a praise.
Yeah, it really it's like not in like the top 5, but it's in that top 10. It's really good.
Interesting.
You're not in the minority, Chris. A lot of people are putting this in like their top 10 for the year and really love it.
They should. It's great.
And then what else have you been checking out, Chris?
I finally watched Anna and the Apocalypse, which is something a lot of people have talked about. You know, Jacob's talked about it a bunch. It's now on Hulu and it's on Amazon Prime. And so I said, "Fine, I will give this a chance." And I liked it. I didn't love it. I loved like the first 20 minutes, like the first few musical numbers are so good and so just giddy and joyful. And I really, really like that. It does this thing. It tries to do this thing that Shaun of the Dead does, where it's both like a silly comedy with like serious moments. And Shaun of the Dead does it so well. And this movie, I don't think, pulls it off. Like, when it tries to get serious, the serious stuff just does not work. But the songs are really good. The soundtrack alone makes this worth seeing. So I enjoyed it. I didn't love it as much as a lot of people do, but I really did like it.
I'm the exact opposite of Chris. I think that the serious stuff works better than the frothy stuff. I think that once it becomes a full-fledged horror musical, as opposed to being a goofy movie with some horror elements, I was really more on board. But I think we both liked it. That's the important thing, Chris. Truce, high five.
Yes, agreed.
HT, what have you been watching recently?
Since I had two long plane trips, I got the chance to catch up on a couple of movies I hadn't seen this year. Although I was a little disappointed that Korean Air, on the way there at least, didn't have quite the big selection that I want to dive into. But I did get to see on the way to Vietnam Late Night, which is the Mindy Kaling movie about a young comedy writer who gets a job at a late night talk show that she has adored all her life, and finds that she is sort of the diversity hire, but works her way up and befriends the icy talk show host played by Emma Thompson. And I really enjoyed this movie. I remember not really having a lot of expectations for it, even though I like Mindy Kaling's work. I think that her comedy writing, when it's good, it's great, but it can be very up and down. I watched all of The Mindy Project, and it's a show that I, for the most part, enjoyed, but it did have like a lot of problems. And I actually enjoyed Late Night a lot for, I feel like, some parts that she kind of poked at her own tendencies to, for example, cast mostly white male leads as her romantic interests. And I think that her and Emma Thompson were really great and funny together, and that the comedy it wasn't like a straight up comedy. It was more of like a dramedy in a sense, which is why a lot of people didn't like it as much when it first came out. But I really enjoyed that more sort of somber aspect and sort of like the look back into the process of late night television. So Late Night was great, and I really enjoyed that.
That's on Amazon Prime right now, I think, right?
Oh, yeah, I think so.
I'm pretty sure it's an Amazon movie, so I think they picked it up from Sundance. Yeah,
it's an Amazon Prime movie. It's there now.
So you can watch it now on Amazon Prime. Another movie that I watched was Long Shot, which I did not like. I have to say this with the caveat that I did watch this on an airplane, which aggressively censored the movie. So I feel like I missed a lot of the punchlines that came in. Yeah, but at the same time, I just did not enjoy this movie. This is the originally titled Flarsky, as Chris will probably remember. And it stars Seth Rogen and Charlize Theron. Charlize Theron is a She's the Secretary of State.
Yeah,
Secretary of State. And she hires Seth Rogen's Fred Flarsky, who's a gifted journalist and her former childhood friend, as her speechwriter. And they get into all sorts of shenanigans before they fall in love and do an unexpected romance. And I did not think it was a funny movie. I think that a lot of the jokes, you know, probably because of the censoring, landed flat to me. And I just was really bothered by the vague politics of this movie. I think that when we've had so much good, sharp political comedies like Veep or like Death of Stalin, which also was vague on the comedy, but was really smart in its sort of portrayal of communist Russia. It just was really unfortunate to me that Longshot just did not care about the politics itself when it's about politics. Mm. So I was not into this movie. And yeah, Chris was right when he made fun of Flarsky the entire time.
I think that's a fair criticism. What else did you watch?
Other movies I watched, I finally saw The Lion King, the new 2019 remake, and man, this is a terrible movie. Well, I think that really watching it on a plane on a 12-inch screen when you're stuck in a cramped quarters for 16 hours is really the best place to watch The Lion King, or like the place that it deserves.
You didn't do the visuals any favors there, HT.
I didn't, but also it's just so visually uninspired, regardless of how much like a National Geographic documentary it looked. And I just found like the shot for shot parts to be really just laughable, especially like in the opening. I was like, wow, they're really just redoing the shots, except it's in 3D now and they can like move the camera around. How cool. Yeah, I was really not impressed by The Lion King, and I was really annoyed by how long the comedy bits went on, which I guess was to help pad the runtime to make it more than 2 hours, which was very needless. And so it was just bad. The comedy was like went on for too long and was not really funny, and then very visually dull and uninspired. And the voice acting too, I was disappointed by, because I think Brad has talked about this before, and this has been a long running problem that I've had with casting celebrities as voice actors, is that they don't really have the intuition when it comes to voice acting, which I think is something that's incredibly different than screen acting. There's just sometimes it just sounds really emotionless, or like if they had physical gestures to go along with it, it would be more effective. But in just voice context, it does not work. So yeah, disappointed by The Lion King.
Even Billy Eichner and Seth Rogen?
They were the only ones that actually pulled it off, as well as John Oliver. I think it's telling the comedians were the ones who were best in this movie, except for Keegan-Michael Key. I found his delivery to be really flat, which I was disappointed by.
Oh, bummer.
Yeah. Another movie I watched that I really enjoyed on the plane is Wild Rose, which is a film that kind of passed me by, but I read recently an article about the original song for this film that was written by, I think,
Mary Steenburgen.
Mary Steenburgen, yeah, exactly. And I was really fascinated by that. So I checked out this film, and it stars Jesse Buckley as a Scottish woman and an ex-con who is fresh out of prison, and she aspires to be a country music star. And she tries to find her way to Nashville, Tennessee to start her career. And this is a movie that I for the most part liked. It was like this really kitchen sink style character drama that I liked for the most part, and then that like grew into love when she sang that final song, and I just started crying in the middle of the plane. It just it's so emotional and so simple and yet powerful, the emotions that it evokes. So it's not game changing by any means, but the emotions are just so laid bare that I really enjoy this movie, and Jessie Buckley is phenomenal in this role. I really liked it, her performance, and I liked this film as well. So that's Wild Rose, which I don't think is streaming anywhere, but if you get the chance to watch it, please do check it out.
Yeah, I also really like this when I saw it at CinemaCon earlier this year. I think that character has a tattoo that says something like three chords and the truth or something along mm-hmm. those lines. Like, that's all you need for a great song. And I feel like that mentality sort of doubles for the movie itself. Like you said, it's a pretty simple story, but it's just like really effectively told. And Jessie Buckley's performance is terrific. I think I didn't even recognize her when she was in Chernobyl earlier this year as well. Like, I was like, this is the same person? Are you kidding me? Like, those performances are so different. I feel like it really shows the range of that actress. And I hope she's somebody that is with us and delivering, you know, great stuff for a long, long time.
Yeah, for sure. And I think that's completely accurate, Ben. And the last movie I saw was Blinded by the Lights, which is directed by Gurinder Chadha, and it follows a Pakistani teenager in 1987 England who discovers the music of Bruce Springsteen and becomes a mega fan and basically starts to live his life by the boss's music and embrace freedom and individuality and independence. And it's a really fun, like, coming of age film. It's really just like this jolt of joy I enjoyed watching it, although I wish it became the full-fledged musical that it gets so close to being. As I was watching it, I kept thinking, wow, this would make a really great stage musical. And it never completely does that. There are some good diegetic musical sequences where he's singing to Bruce Springsteen's music, and it basically plays like a musical sequence, but never like goes that far. And I just kept thinking that I really enjoyed this as like a full-fledged jukebox musical. It's still like really fun and really sweet and just joyful. So I would recommend this too. That's Blinded by the Light.
Awesome. Jacob, what have you been watching recently?
I watched a few episodes of The Movies That Made Us, the Netflix series. It's a sequel series to The Toys That Made Us. And I never watched Toys That Made Us, but I was on the exercise bike and I said I need to put something on what's light and easy to watch. So I decided to give this a chance, and I really hate the presentation of the show. It has a real wild guy narrator. Well, hijinks. And I hated that so much. I almost turned it off immediately. But the thing is, they have interviews with people who have such great stories. Like, I watched, I don't like Home Alone, but the Home Alone episode is the best one of the season that I watched, because it's not just Chris Columbus, you know, the director, and Daniel Stern, you know, who plays Marv in the movie. But it's like the second AD and the cinematographer and the editor, the unit production manager, all sharing stories from the set, and all of them having reached a point in their careers or have reached the age where they don't give a shit about hiding the truth or being or trying to make things seem tidy. It was just full of, like, all the episodes I've watched have been full of people just sharing honest stories about their time making stuff like Die Hard and Ghostbusters and Home Alone and Dirty Dancing. And I really wish the presentation wasn't so campy and so like Disney Channel in its approach, because the content itself is not. The content itself is like the blue collar workers on these classic movies sharing great stories and alongside the actual filmmakers. Have anyone else watched this yet? Because I'm curious what you guys think.
I've been meaning not. To, yeah, because I do like The Toys That Made Us. And I was hoping that this series would be something more than just like the usual glossy, oh man, we have such fond memories of making this movie. So I'm glad to hear you say what you did.
Yeah, I'll give you an example. It was a great story that I'd never heard before, where Home Alone was originally a Warner Brothers movie, and they shut it down due to it going $1 million over budget into pre-production. And Warner Brothers discreetly, Fox discreetly picked it up. So literally a Warner Brothers exec was going from room to room in production offices, firing everybody, while someone from the production was going behind him after he left the room saying, nope, Fox got us, we're back on. And so it was like really fun stories like that, something I'd never heard before, that like really bring it to life. So if you're on Netflix, each episode is like 45 minutes long. And I found it illuminating and fun, especially like hearing, you know, stories from people who aren't, you know, actors and directors, people who like got their hands dirty on those film sets. So that's The Movies That Made Us on Netflix. Over on Disney Plus, I watched childhood favorite The Love Bug, the first Herbie movie, the car with a mind of his own. And in the first one, Herbie is purchased by a down-as-luck race car driver who turns into a champion with Herbie doing all the hard work. And this movie, I watched it maybe 100 times as a kid, wore out the VHS tape. And this movie is freaking weird, guys. And it's so weird that here it is streaming in high definition on Disney+. I remember all the, you know, living car gets into hijinks stuff. I did not remember that it is set in San Francisco in the 60s. It's set, like, in when it was made. And, like, movies full of, like, really unique San Francisco touches. Like, it makes good use of location. There are hippies and weirdos. And like, the culture clash is kind of present on screen in a way I found satisfying. It has a really good musical score. Like, really zippy, like, in-your-head musical score. And I had totally forgotten. I just did not put this up as a kid. That the explanation for why Herbie may be a living car comes from Buddy Hackett's character, who went to Tibet, had a spiritual awakening, and realizes that we've put so much technology in the cars, we've made our machines so powerful that they have we spend so much time with them, that they start to transform and evolve and think that they're human. So that's why Herbie is a living car. I totally forgot about that. But anyway, love bug. And also, it's a really emblematic of the 1960s live action Disney canon. It's campy, it's too long, it's really not that great, but man, is it a nostalgia trip, a dangerous nostalgia trip, where I am probably recommending a movie that probably isn't actually good? I really enjoyed visiting Love Bug. Does anybody else have any strong childhood memories of the Love Bug?
I saw it when I was probably like 5 and don't remember it. I haven't revisited it since, and it sounds like I probably shouldn't, but did anybody else grow up watching this movie?
No, never.
Anyway, all the sequels are also on Disney Plus. Those ones I remember even as a kid thinking they weren't especially great. So that's the Love Bug on Disney Plus. And finally, I watched The Girl on the Third Floor. This is a new film from Travis Stevens. He's usually a producer and writer for a lot of really cool genre films, indie films. And this is, I believe, his directorial debut. And it stars former wrestler CM Punk, who's actually really good here, kind of doing a Bruce Campbell-esque performance, as a guy who has barely escaped being prosecuted for a crime, moving to the Chicago suburbs and trying to renovate a haunted house for his family. And it's essentially a movie about a house that kills toxic men. And it's about a extremely bad, bad person who faces off against a haunted house that has a vendetta against men who abuse women. And it reaches Evil Dead levels of gore and craziness. And CM Punk, this is his first, I believe, leading role in a film. And he's really good, actually. He has a self-effacing quality that really works. And he's not afraid to make himself look bad. He's very physical. And he has a cartoon face. Like, he looks like a cartoon come to life, which serves the material really well. That is The Girl on the Third Floor. I rented it on Amazon. I'm not sure if it's streaming anywhere yet, but it's worth a few bucks if you want to rent it.
Do you think CM Punk is going to be the next big, like, wrestler-turned-actor?
Man, I don't think he has, you know, the mainstream appeal of The Rock. I mean, like, I know WWE fans loved CM Punk. He did not quit wrestling willingly, from what I understand. There was a big clash with him and the creatives there. But I would love for him to, like, get more lead roles, because I'm not sure what his range is, but there's an undeniable presence to him. There's an undeniable Bruce Campbell-esque, I am a Looney Tunes cartoon come to life. I'm going to do the craziest shit imaginable with a straight face. Not everybody can pull it off. And I feel like it's a unique thing that is unique to Bruce Campbell and professional wrestlers. So I hope we see more of him.
Awesome. Brad, what else have you been watching?
I went to a press screening of Little Women when I was in Chicago earlier this week. And it is one of my favorite movies of the year. It is an outstanding adaptation of Little Women. Greta Gerwig manages to make it feel like it's a modern story without losing, like, the classic sensibilities. Not in a way that feels like Dickinson or anything like that. And the ensemble cast here is just, wow. It's been a long time since I felt like a cast has had such good, lively, infectious chemistry. Everyone is so great in this movie together. I was just so enraptured and just caught up in this movie simply because of how great the performances were. But it also takes a great approach to the story, too. It's not a linear telling of the story. It cuts back and forth in time, which I actually think makes it stronger. And I find myself just like falling more and more in love with this movie as it went on. And I was more surprised that I loved this as much as I did.
Man, that sounds awesome. I'm very jealous of you. I'm looking forward to seeing this. It's like one of my most anticipated movies of the rest of the year. So I know me and HC both are looking forward to this one a lot. HC, you get to see this one soon, right?
I've been looking forward to this forever, but yes, I'm seeing it next week finally, and I'll be reviewing it for Slash Film as well.
Awesome. What else have you been watching, Brad?
I watched a few episodes of Nailed It Holiday Edition. I had been enjoying Great British Bake Off recently, and my girlfriend and I wanted to watch something a little bit different since we don't have any other episodes of that to watch right now. And we decided to give this a shot, mostly because I like the celebrity guest judges, and I also heard that Paul Scheer was a contestant on the show. And we haven't quite gotten to that episode yet, but we watched a couple, and I gotta say, the show is entertaining to a point, but it's just so much more obnoxious and over the top than Great British Bake Off that it's kind of grating at times. Like, I love Jason Mantzoukas and I love his energy, but that combined with Nicole Byers, the host, I was just like, whoa, this is a little too much, guys. Thankfully, the episode with Maya Rudolph toned things down a little bit and was a little more fun. The most entertaining thing to me so far is just, man, how bad these baking projects turn out to be. Like, it is so laughable to see how poor these people's instincts are when it comes to doing things properly and getting things done. And there's definitely an aspect to it of where I think that they intentionally give the bakers less time than they probably would need to actually pull this off, even if they were somewhat skilled bakers. And it's very funny from that perspective, but I just wish that it was a little less crazy. I just feel like they're trying too much for the, whoa, look at this wacky baking show.
Sounds like it has that in common with the movies that made us a little bit.
Yeah, Chris, you like Nailed It, don't you? How do you feel about that?
I love it. I gotta say, I tried it once months, like when it first started, and I was actually in that same boat where I was like, oh, this is too wacky for me. But then I gave it a second chance, and I don't know, it's really grown on me. I love it. I love the Jason Mantzoukas episodes because they're so, like, insane, and he's just like constantly screaming, and that can be annoying, but he makes it funny. Like, there's that just to me shows how, like, genuinely amusing he is as a performer, because I've seen other people who do that shtick where their whole thing is like just screaming and it gets really old really fast, but he finds a way to make it work. And I don't know, I really like it just because it's very uncomplicated. I can just watch it and I hate this term, but you know, turn my brain off. I love it.
All right, that's Nailed It Holiday Edition. That's on Netflix right now. Let's jump into what we've been eating. Brad, as per usual, you're eating a bunch of weird stuff. So what's on your what was on your menu recently?
So along with everything else I did in Chicago, my girlfriend and I ate at this place called Eataly, which is this big, like, two-floor combination Italian grocery market with a bunch of smaller restaurants in it, like cafe style stuff and things like that. And my girlfriend had been wanting to go there for a while, so we finally checked it out for lunch on her birthday. We went to the part that's called La Pizza and La Pasta. Pretty simple, but they have Neapolitan pizza, and they have delicious, you know, like, made from scratch pasta, and man, this was so good. Normally I'm not like the biggest fan of Neapolitan pizzas because I like the spread of cheese usually on it and that kind of thing. And the Neapolitan does like the dollops of mozzarella and stuff. But the flavors and with this pizza were so good. Like the crust was perfectly thin, and normally I don't eat all of, like, the crust on a pizza, but this one was just so perfectly baked and crisp and delicious. And it had spicy salami on it, and the cheese was enormously satisfying. And the pasta that we had was even better. I wish I remember exactly which pasta we had, but it had a creamy ricotta sauce that went with it, and also Italian sausage, and a white truffle touch. I don't know how to describe it, but it was delicious. I'm not an Italian chef, but it was delicious. Easily one of the best pasta dishes I've had in such a long time. And the whole place itself is just really cool. It's chock full of stuff that is imported from Italy, so they have a lot of, like, Italian sodas. They have gelato there. They have all this pasta and bread and ingredients and sauces, and just it's awesome. There's so much cool stuff there, and it's definitely a little the market itself is a little bit pricey, as you would anticipate, since it's imported stuff. The restaurants, though, are not too bad. It's no more expensive than if you were to go to, like, a chain restaurant, and the food is infinitely better.
Yeah, definitely. There's a few Eataly locations around the country. I know there's one in New York. There's one here in Los Angeles, obviously Chicago. So yeah, definitely. I would second that recommendation. Like, I've been to the one in LA a couple times and the food is always tremendous. So yeah, that's Eataly. What else have you been eating, Brad?
So on the candy side of things, I found some things that I was very excited about. So back when I was a kid, they released different variations of Twix for like the first time ever. And it included peanut butter for the first time. But the one that I loved the most was Twix Cookies and Cream. And this is something that has stuck with me since I was a kid, because I only ever found it a couple times, but I remember just loving it so much. And Twix has still been my favorite candy bar for the longest time, the regular one. And I just always hoped that they would bring it back. And they finally did this year. So far, it's only in the form of Twix Minis, but I was so excited. And I will say that it's still good. And I don't know if it's because I've built it up in my mind so much from being a kid and just remembering how good it was. It wasn't quite as good as I hoped. And I think some of it is because Oreo has done a better job of doing cookies and cream in the form of a candy bar with their own Oreo chocolate bar with cookies and cream filling. But it's still a pretty good Twix bar. It doesn't taste remarkably different from a Twix aside from the absence of caramel. But it's, I still enjoyed it. You know, I guess I'm still chasing that childhood Twix dream though.
There's a different Kit Kat that you ate as well, right?
Yeah, Kit Kat came out with a new, they're calling it Duos, and it's a mint Duos flavor where it's part dark chocolate on the bottom, and then a mint chocolate on top with the regular wafer in the middle. And this is great. It tastes like an Andes mint candy bar, but with the Kit Kat wafer in between, which is my jam totally. I love mint chocolate. I don't like dark chocolate by itself, but when it's paired with mint chocolate, I'm all about it, and that's great. So that's all in stores everywhere. You can find it right now. And then when we were at the market, the German Christmas market in Chicago, one of the places they had a bunch of like international candy, and so Rittersport is this great chocolate that they have different flavor variations on with different fillings, and two that I hadn't seen before. One of them had cornflakes, bits of cornflakes in it, and the other one had like a biscuit filling, which is like as the UK, it's a cookie filling basically. And both were fantastic. The cornflakes was so good. The biscuit one was my favorite, just because it reminds me of the British biscuits that have like the chocolate on them that are a little bit buttery and good. But those are good. Rittersport chocolates, if you ever see those, like they oftentimes have them in like the international aisles at grocery stores. You'll find them with a lot of other British chocolates and stuff like that. Those are good.
Cool. All right, that's going to bring us to the end of today's episode of Slash Film Daily. Let's go around the circle really quickly and tell people where they can find more of our work online. Jacob, let's start with you.
Slashfilm.com every single day, and I'm on Twitter where I'm at Jacob S. Hall.
HT?
Also Slashfilm.com, and I'm on Twitter at HTranBuoy.
Brad?
Slashfilm.com, at Ethan_Anderson on Twitter, and my podcast, Go Flix Yourself.
Chris?
Believe it or not, I'm at slashfilm.com. Also, I'm on Twitter at cevangelista413.
I am also at slashfilm.com. You can find me on Twitter and Instagram at Ben Pears. And you can find this podcast, Slash Film Daily, published every weekday, bringing you the most exciting news from the world of movies and TV, as well as deeper dives into the great features you can find on the site. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes, Google Podcasts, Overcast, Spotify, all the popular podcast apps, and send your feedback, questions, comments, and concerns to us at peter@slashfilm.com. Make sure to leave your name and general geographic location in case we mention your email on the air. And don't forget to rate and review the podcast on iTunes. Tell your friends, spread the word, and we will talk to you next time.
Ben.
Yes.
I have to go quickly. I am in a hurry, so I have to open up the Gargantuan Book of Insult Defense and Infrontery by Louis Safian and move as fast as I can.
Okay.
Oh, boy.
All right, I'm up to the egotist section. Ben, if you're really self-made, you have no one to blame but yourself.
Okay, all right.
Oh, Brad, I hear you laughing. You claim you're self-made, but too bad you left off the working parts.
Oh, no.
Oh, HT, when she brags that she's a self-made woman, you can't help wonder who interrupted her.
Oof.
Mm. Oh.
And Chris, he'll never install machines that can do employees' jobs. When he talks, they couldn't listen and nod.
We should end the show right now.
Yes, goodbye.
This is the story of the one. As a maintenance engineer, he hears things differently. To the untrained ear, everything on his shop floor might sound fine, but he can hear gears grinding or a belt slipping. so he steps in to fix the problem at hand before it gets out of hand. And he knows Granger's got the right product he needs to get the job done, which is music to his ears. Call, click Granger.com, or just stop by. Granger, for the ones who get it done.
When you need mealtime inspiration, it's worth shopping Kroger, where you'll find over 30,000 mouthwatering choices that excite your inner foodie. And no matter what tasty choice you make, you'll enjoy our everyday low prices, plus extra ways to save, like digital coupons worth over $600 each week. You can also save up to $1 off per gallon at the pump with fuel points. More savings and more inspiring flavors make shopping Kroger worth it every time. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Fuel restrictions apply.